The Writer's Toolkit is published by Nick Hearn Books. Order direct from the publisher and get 20% off this and other great titles. Visit nickhearnbooks.co.uk. This is the Writer's Toolkit podcast.
Welcome to the Writer's Toolkit podcast. In this episode, we're talking all about the world of play readings, a vital stage in the development of new writing. Whether a simple, casual table read or a more involved, rehearsed reading for an invited audience, whatever the format or style of the reading, hearing our work aloud can help refine it and understand how it translates from page to stage.
The Writer's Toolkit Podcast with Paul Kalbergi.
Joining me in conversation today are Mimi Collins and Rachel Lynette. Mimi is the UK Artistic Director of Bespoke Plays, a transatlantic collective presenting elevated readings. And Rachel is a queer Afro-Latinx playwright who writes dark comedies about complex and complicated women of colour. Mimi and Rachel share their thoughts, perspectives, and some of the ways they've been sharing their work with audiences, from staged readings in theatre spaces to online offerings in the digital space.
Coming up.
I can't recommend that enough, to just put a little lighting on your unfinished piece.
Instant atmosphere, instant mood.
Instant mood. I love a blue light.
If your play is longer than 2 hours, don't you dare. Don't you dare. Like, no, thank you. No, we're not. No, absolutely not. If you don't do a 4-hour play on a Zoom reading, please don't do that to us.
The Writer's Toolkit Podcast.
All right, let's dive in. After getting her start as a writer and director at Upright Citizens Brigade in Los Angeles, Mimi Collins was a finalist for the Nickelodeon Writing Programme in 2019, and she's also directed a slate of short films. Born in London, Mimi spent much of her life in the United States before returning to the UK last year, where she's taken up the role as UK Artistic Director of Bespoke Plays, a collective that creates opportunities for writers by producing customised play readings. Originally in LA and New York, and now in London. Mimi, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Maybe you can start by telling us first a bit about the origins of Bespoke Plays.
So Christine Boylan and Ellie Pyle are our founders. They began it, I want to say 2019. All of the founders on the board are all people who work in the industry, but they maybe don't always get to do what they want, and they're not always getting to fill their creative cups. And they missed doing art and doing the things that was pouring out of their soul. So they got together and they started doing these staged readings and wanting to push the envelope more and more of what is a staged reading. And I found them during COVID, where one of the board members is a friend of mine, and he invited me to come into their Sequestered Sundays, which was their Sunday reading series, and share some of my work. And also just people showed up every Sunday. There was 40, 50 people actors read a new work and then give feedback and have Q&A. I was still in Los Angeles at the time. And then my husband and I moved here after he attended the Bristol Theatre School MFA program. And I was just itching to do stuff. And also himself and his classmates who all moved here are just beyond talented, crazy talented, but they're also all new to London. And it just takes a minute for people to get to know you and want to give you things to do. And I just thought, I have access to these incredibly talented actors who, for this tiny moment in time, have some extra time on their hands, because that's not going to last very long for any of them. They're going to be available to me for a blip. So I said, let's do stuff. Let's start putting stuff on its feet. It's a great way for actors to have something to bring their agents to, or casting directors. That's just, not going to eat up 6 weeks or 6 months of their life. It doesn't take them away from any other opportunities. And it's a way to get, new work out there, new voices, give people a chance to flex different muscles.
Yeah, and to be flexing those muscles in the theatre.
Yes.
With our collaborators.
And I think that's so huge. That's where we learn and grow.
Without doubt. Without doubt. So just to expand on that a little bit then, why do you think public readings are so vital to the development of new writing?
I think it has to do with taking your work out of that vacuum, right? That as writers, you're so often in a room by yourself or with a cat, and that the script is never finished. right? It's never a finished, closed, locked piece of art. It's a living, breathing creature that sometimes gets away from you. And so the more, I think the more factors you can bring in to your script, be that actor saying it out loud, be that an audience reacting, the stronger you're going to make it and the more you're going to learn. And I think the audience is a huge factor in knowing what the impact of your script is, which is hard, of course, because you slave over this thing and you pour all your love and sweat and heart and soul into it, and then you can take it out into the world and people don't get it, or what you're intending isn't coming across, and obviously that's really, really hard, but we have to find out at some point.
Yeah, stand back and watch it burn or watch it fly.
Yeah, and I think the thing with readings is it's a lower monetary barrier to getting your work in front of an audience, and it's a little, you can be a little riskier. You don't have to spend as much money putting a reading on, and so it doesn't have to be perfect. You can go and crash and burn, and there's a lot to learn from that too, and really learn the most from that.
So what makes a bespoke reading special? What are the hallmarks of a bespoke reading?
I think what we do, our readings are a little bit more stood up. So we block them. The actors will move around the stage. We also light them. And the reason we do these things is to let the audience enjoy it a little bit more. The audience doesn't have to remember what the narrator just said. They are watching them move from room to room. In our first one we had a lot of secret conversations. And I think if everyone's just like sitting at a table, it could be hard to remember who is hearing this and who's not.
Yeah.
And so I think that's something that what Bespoke Plays does that is a little bit different. And again, it does like bring the audience in, and you want an audience who's there and on side, because that's how you're going to find out if you're doing what you intended to do as the writer.
Yeah, because they can be quite difficult to sit through, a reading of new work that isn't on its feet.
And
try to stay engaged.
Yeah, I have the hardest time just like listening to people. I almost always request, like during lockdown, Bespoke Plays did something called Sequestered Sundays, where every Sunday we did a reading of new works from within the group, and the actors showed up. Like, they would get the script ahead of time, they would do their work. These were not cold reads, but I would also always, if it wasn't my piece, I would always request a script, because I want to read along. Because it can be hard. And so those often turn into like industry only events where it's just the producers, which is obviously awesome and the goal. But there is something really magical about also just having people there to enjoy some theater at a low. The idea is obviously it's a lower price point for everyone. It doesn't have to be a £20 ticket. And hopefully for the company, we're not having to spend as much because there's no props, there's no costumes, there's less rehearsal time. So we're not having to keep the actors for quite as long. And it lets everyone like flex their muscle and get up and do what they love on a more regular basis. I think we're going to have 7 new works up this year.
Wow.
That are going to get, you know, heard. And we do invite industry, and we also invite, you know, just people who love the theater.
Yeah.
And I think the important thing is just getting new words out in the air and new ideas and new thoughts, and giving more artists a chance to do their work and share what they want to do.
Definitely. And for audiences to get to sit in on that early kind of, you know, watching an artist at work and see that new work develop.
Getting to peek behind the curtain a little bit. So I always give a little like, hello, this is what we're doing, in case anyone missed like the stage reading part.
Yes. Like, yes.
This is why they're holding scripts. It's not a mistake.
Yes. We haven't not bothered to learn our lines.
But what I always do tell the audience is that they are an essential part of this process.
Yep.
And they really are another factor. And especially because with the Bespoke Plays, we always have the stage directions being read. And we make sure that that is a way to like really connect the audience. It's very rare that we just have someone like sitting off to the side saying them. They almost always, we try to integrate them a little bit.
Okay.
So most writers, when they put something out for Bespoke, will do an extra pass with the idea that the stage directions are going to be out loud and that this person is a bit of a character. So in the first one we did this year, our stage directions reader had an opinion about everything. And in some of the high action moments, he actually got up and entered the scenes and moved around the actors in what I think was a really impactful way, because there was some action that like without any budget you can't do.
Almost commenting on what he's observing in the scene, moving the audience with him.
Yeah, and almost puppeteering some, like that was kind of his vibe. Yeah. And then this one we just did a two-hander at the OSO in Barnes called Analog. And we had the actors read each other's stage directions.
Oh.
So they narrated what the other was doing throughout.
Okay.
As like an aside to the audience. which was, it worked so well. I was very proud of that idea because it worked really well. It kept it really intimate. It was a very intimate, tense play. And everything they said about the other had a judgment to it because it was a very much a play where they were watching each other really closely. So everything that it was kind of a comment, like an inner monologue moment.
That's so interesting.
For this next one, I do have one of the characters who is the overlooked character that oft gets forgotten will be reading the stage directions because they're also the one who sees everything, even though nobody sees them. So there's things like that. I think what we don't try and do is hide that it's a reading.
No.
We don't try and make it pass for a full production. We like to like embrace the reading aspect, have fun with the stage directions, have fun with the audience being there, and just make sure that what we're doing, which is very specific, is celebrated.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do wonder also if there's something the writer would see in hearing their work that way with the narration involved to that extent, if you would find and discover things that you might want to take forward into the next draft and incorporate into the piece.
I think for the first one we did this year, that was one of mine. I had written that. And I think we're going to have to, because we are trying to mount that as a full production later this year. But as I said, there's a lot of action that, like, I don't think anyone's about to give me a bunch of money. So I think we still might be, while everyone will be off book and there will be like a set and some props and costumes, I think there might still be a bit of a narration angle. And I think that's cool.
I think almost lean into it.
Exactly. And I do think it engages the audience in an interesting way where they feel a part of it. And I think anytime you can bring your audience into your work is just going to enhance the effect you have on them.
Maybe we can look at Water Party, the first play that you staged with Bespoke Plays in London, and use that as a bit of a case study.
Yeah.
So from first draft to public reading, what did that look like?
Yeah, so Water Party was one of the first things that Bespoke ever read in Sequestered Sun, of mine, not overall, of mine. It was the first thing I was brave enough to bring to this incredibly intimidating group of talent. So there was a group of actors, basically, and writers. Some do both, some just do one or the other, directors, and they would meet every Sunday. And these are basically people who'd been involved in Bespoke plays before the lockdown, and then also their trusted creative friends, and it grew to this like really gorgeous warm community that is still always there for each other. And so I brought it to this Sequestered Sundays, and they said, sure, yes, please bring us this. And it was written as a short to film. The actors crushed it. I couldn't believe how much they gave of themselves to it. And then the feedback that I got from it was really powerful and wonderful. But it is at its core a dinner party. And I love a dinner party on stage. Okay.
Yeah,
and so then I got to London, and London has such an appetite for new work. And theatre is felt a lot more accessible here than Los Angeles. And I said, I want to do something with my friends. And I have this piece, and it has six people in it, seven with a narrator. And that's a lot of people. And I have, that's about how many friends I have.
You're doing well. And I haven't got that many.
And so I booked the Union Theatre. And then I said, I got to make this a full play now.
Well, how did that come about? Just stop you there, because even booking a theatre is no mean feat, you know, especially in London. What was the arrangement there?
So I WhatsApped everyone I know and I said, what theatres exist? And they gave me a bunch of names, and I emailed a bunch of theatres, and someone like, yeah, sure, come on down. We're £9,000 a night. And I was like, oh, cool.
Great, I'll do a week.
Yeah. And you're like, neat. And then some were like, we're 300. I know, it was actually incredibly intimidating. No two theatre cities are the same, at least completely different to London. So it was just a lot of emailing and asking really stupid questions. For anyone who's listening who's confused, I was born in London. I've been in the States a long time, which is why my accent is weird. But I have a hint of an English accent. So I'm also asking like really stupid questions with an English accent. And they're like, why don't you know this? And sometimes I'll go very American to be like, can I ask a dumb question? So it was really literally cold emailing. It was actually getting on my Google Maps and like typing theater and kind of seeing where they were and being like, oh, that's kind of a good looking area that people can get to. I guess let's email them. And a lot of recon and visiting theaters. The Union Theater was a good price, a really good setup, and incredibly kind and welcoming people who were just like so warm, did not make me feel silly at all.
Okay.
And
were you working
location.
On a box office split, or did you have to shell out and then with a view to recoup on ticket sales?
No, it was no box office split. It was a flat rate, but not up front.
Okay.
So it was just, I didn't have to pay anything up front with them, which was
okay.
Wild.
Wow, that's good.
Then there was a rehearsal space that was available. they said, just come in and then we'll sell the tickets and we'll either bill you or send you money.
Brilliant.
Which I knew we were going to get a bill because we set our ticket prices very low we held a lot for comps, but we did sell out. And I was like, all my friends are on stage. I don't know who is coming to this. But we did sell out, which was amazing.
Fantastic.
And honoring. And we only did one night because I was nervous. We're going to do two nights going forward because I'm slightly braver. But that was wonderful. And they were really warm and lovely. And we always make sure we have somewhere where you can drink afterwards. Because Bespoke is first and foremost a community. And we're so excited to get to know UK creatives, because we are the core of us right now, are transplants. And I'm leaning on my LA and New York people. And so I'm excited to like put our roots down here. So we want to make sure we can hang out afterwards. People can ask questions. People can get involved. We're not like a super strong gatekeepy. Like, you want to send me a script, send me a script. My DMs are open. Like, get in touch. Let's see what's going on. You want to direct something? Cool. I don't need to direct all of these. I probably won't be able to. You want to be in something? Like, please. So we are branching out with our actors. And so that was, I just emailed a bunch of theaters. I won't lie. It took a lot of time. It was exhausting and overwhelming and scary, because I felt like I had no idea what I was doing. And even at the Union Theatre, I just felt like I had so many silly questions. And of like, hey, can I get in here for a rehearsal the night before? Not knowing if like, is that absurd? Or is that, how much more money is it? Or do you know what I mean? And just those kinds of things. And some theatres are more buttoned up. The one we just went to, we did the OSO in Barnes, and that is a bit more, everything has a price and they let you know and you pay it up front. And then they'll send you. So every theater is different. And every theater also serves the piece differently. Mm. The Union Theater is a flat stage where the seats are tiered up behind it.
Yeah.
The OSO is a raised stage. It's just different pieces want to be in different spaces.
Yeah.
It also sat 65, which I was intimidated by. I was trying to find a place that sat like 30, because again, all my friends were on stage.
Yes.
But we did. We sold out and it was good. And then, the OSO sits 85 and... that was also a little intimidating, but we did it.
A step up.
So that was it. We found the Union Theatre. We found a date that they had available. And that was a trial and error. Because these theatres, that's also the thing. In England, these theatres book up so far in advance. No one in LA makes plans that far in advance. Nobody knows what they're doing in 6 weeks. That's wild. So I did have to learn a bit, like, I can't just like come in and be like, can I put a show on next week? Which is just a very LA way of living.
Okay. But you want that window of time in terms of any marketing that you're going to do, right? To be able to fill your house.
Yes. Here you do. Again, in LA, no one's committing to anything until maybe 2 weeks before. So it doesn't really matter. You can tell them 6 weeks out. They won't remember.
Okay.
So, or they might, something better might come on, honestly. It's LA. So that was interesting too. Yeah, like all of the industry people want 6 weeks. So we learned about that, which is great. And so we booked in with the lovely Sasha at the Union Theatre for one night. We sent her our art, our copy. She put it on her website, which I really wanted to find a place that would like, I didn't want to have to make an Eventbrite. I'm already doing a lot.
That's another hat.
It's already my own piece that I wrote that I'm directing in a new city.
Yeah.
And I had to do like lighting design. I mean, I didn't do, but I had to find someone. And then I think it was just about being honest about what I didn't know and what I needed and trying to surround myself with people who knew better than me. And then I booked the space without a finished script. So that was great.
So where was the script at this point then, in terms of draft wise?
It was a 20 page long short for the screen.
Okay. But in first draft stage, or had you done any kind of like pizza reading or like?
Yeah, that had been read in that form had been read at the Sequestered Sundays. And the actors were on board just from reading the short script, and they were asking for the finished script. And you'll get it. You'll get it. You'll get it soon. And I hunkered down the week basically between Christmas and New Year's and said, let's finish this. And I did. And I gave it to them. But we rewrote the whole time throughout the process. I made these little like booklets for them to have on stage. Because there's a lot of action again in this one. So they could move really easily and hold them with one hand instead of like the binder system.
pages everywhere.
Yeah, with like the flipping and the two, you know, I wanted something they could have in one hand, but like 3 days before we were actually up, I was bringing new pages and like with like scissors and tape and being like, here's a crafts table, guys, put your new pages in, sorry.
But that's the joy of having something that's malleable and moldable and a working draft that we're saying this is an experimental phase in the development of this piece.
Well, and if you get curious actors, they're going to ask you stuff and push back on stuff and say, I don't understand this. Why would my character do this? And she's like, well, because I made a mistake. Or, you know, or, oh, let's cut it. Or you're right that, you know, that's a weak, and it's, which is wonderful. I think it's really important to foster that environment where they feel like they can do that and they can push back.
Questions are what we want.
100%. And it was, it was a bit overwhelming. We had 2 weeks. I try and do a 2 week time frame for rehearsals. We do not rehearse for 2 weeks. That's wild.
Yeah.
But like each week I'll try to see everyone 2 to 3 times. So there's time for everything to kind of settle in.
So you weren't doing whole group rehearsals every time?
No, God, no. 7 people with jobs.
Did you manage to get everyone together a couple of times?
Twice. I always asked them to black out the day before the show. And yeah, we had twice where I had everyone, and otherwise I had little groups.
Where were you doing that? What did that look like?
Oh, mostly in people's apartments.
Okay.
And again, these are my friends. Yeah. So it was okay to be like, can we come to your house?
Yeah,
we were in each other's living rooms. And that's what it was. And that obviously that made it tricky to block. The blocking took time.
Yeah.
But again, was like a really wonderful collaborative group effort. And then a couple times the theater was really kind and let us use the space. Probably because they could see I was panicking.
Yeah.
And I felt like a really warm audience.
And the audience want you to succeed as well. They're part of something.
Yeah, exactly.
They've agreed to come on this journey and not see a fully realized piece. So they want to see it succeed.
Exactly. And that feels so nice. That's so rewarding, I think. And yeah, for Water Party, the actors slayed. They gave it so much. Got the assignment. They were like, no, we're standing up, we're doing this. And it's funny, there gets a moment where the actors are like, I want to be off book because we're doing so much other stuff. And I'm like, well, we're not doing that.
Yeah.
We don't have the time. And you don't want to be a little bit off book.
No.
And the essential thing that we always try and remember is that the stage readings are for the writer. You've got to get their words right, because it's an exercise for them to see what we're going to do next, and where their piece is, and is it ready to be produced? How do you feel about it? And so we do, like, certainly the writer is always invited to be along for the entire process and deferred to a lot.
Yeah.
Like this last one, when the writer and I were side by side for the whole thing, and I had some really fun ideas, I thought, for the direction, but all of them were run by her first to make sure they were in line with her vision, because it isn't about the director for the stage readings. It's not about the actors. It's about the writer getting the most out of doing that. So we do try and keep that in the forefront of our minds. And then, and then we try and get, like, let the, you know, blocking is always like blocking and tech and doing the lighting. The lighting, I think, is the single easiest way to really up the production value.
Just elevates it, right?
Oh my gosh, like that. With the amount of, like, effort that goes in versus the payoff is... I can't recommend that enough, to just put a little lighting on your unfinished piece.
Instant atmosphere, instant mood. Yeah.
Instant mood. I love a blue light. That's probably my... I'm always like, where can I make it blue?
Yeah.
I love when lights go out and you make it blue. I love when blue means black.
If in doubt, make it blue.
But it's a lot. It's just, it's always a lot, and it always kind of feels like it's never going to come together. And then it just does, because everyone really wants it to.
As it relates to the broader theme of this season of the Writer's Toolkit and what we can do to kind of channel creative frustrations into something positive and being proactive, I think what you're doing is really encouraging.
Well, I think that is, you know, I think you have to be doing, but I do think everyone, I think writers can feel maybe like they're the only ones who have to spend a lot of time waiting around for someone to want to do something. But I think everyone feels that way. Actors are just waiting around to get cast. Directors are waiting around for someone to give them, to trust them, like everyone, and writers are waiting around for someone to say, I like your script, want to do it.
Yeah.
I think it's just about finding people who you want to spend time with.
Definitely.
That is like my first and foremost. There are so many talented people in this world.
Yep.
I have absolutely no time for anyone who's talented and not also fun to be around.
Yes.
Like life's too short.
Yeah.
No one's the most talented, and no one's honestly, for me, no one's talented enough to put up with not being a pleasure to be around.
Yeah,
so absolutely. I think the thing is to surround yourself with people you like who love what they do.
Yeah.
Because that also, to me, trumps talent. Well, is like the passion and
absolutely.
The drive.
I'm always the first to say, you know, like I'm not the most talented writer in the world, but what I have is tenacity and that kind of passion to make stuff happen and, you know, to knock on doors and kind of, you know, push through.
Yeah.
So I love being around those kind of people like yourself who are actively making stuff happen, you know.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, no, I think we learned so much off of that first one. It was a lot of emails. It took a lot of time.
But what a brilliant learning curve, you know.
What a, steep.
Yeah. I remember in
I learned much. No, you go.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say back in the day, because in a previous life, I was a TV producer for about 10 years. And I self-produced my very first show on The Fringe in 2005 on the Battersea Barge.
Amazing.
It was a kind of one-person comedy cabaret. And I hadn't even realized that all of the sketches in this were standalone kind of TV show ideas, like segments from shows that were really popular at the time, like Changing Rooms, and there was a reality show called The Cruise. So they were all kind of little fragmented bits of TV shows. And I hadn't actually realized that they were all just funny sketches that I'd written as standalone sketches. So we put the whole thing together within the framework of it being the story of a crumbling TV network, and the audience were invited in as potential investors to save this crumbling TV channel, kind of born out of the millennium boom of all of these multi-channel networks. So we put this show on for 3 weeks at the Broccoli Jack Theatre, and it was half live on stage and half pre-recorded. So some of the sketches we filmed and kind of showed the audience as pre-recorded sketches while we were getting changed, and some of the sketches we did live in the studio as kind of live tapings.
That's so fun.
And it gave the show this kind of framework. But because through filming the pre-recorded parts of the show, I really enjoyed that. I thought, actually, maybe TV production is really where I want to be.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of segued into TV production organically, and Fringe Theatre and writing got left behind a little bit,
mm-hmm.
and had the kind of, maybe through bravado of youth, had the tenacity to think I could self-produce a 6-part mm-hmm. celebrity reality TV series, make it, sell it to a network, get it on TV. And I did.
Yeah.
And I made this show, Lauren Harry's Working 9 to 5.
Amazing.
Brought her to London with this concept of 5 jobs in 40 hours, put her to work across various tasks across the week, everything from being an estate agent to a fishmonger at Billingsgate Market to hosting a radio show, 5 really crazy jobs. Made this show and took it to Zai Bennett, who was the controller of ITV2 at the time, sat down in his office. And I remember him saying to me, you know, the learning journey that you've been on is probably the equivalent to, you know, doing like a bachelor's degree in production or something. This is such a brilliant learning opportunity. And they didn't take the show. It ended up going on a small cable network. But I remember him saying that to me, and it was like somebody saying, you know, you haven't wasted your time. It's been a really crucial learning experiment.
Yeah.
So I just think any time that you kind of go on a journey and make something happen, all the learning that you collect across that is just invaluable, you know, and they're all skills that you now have that you'll take forward into wherever else you do this next, and will just get easier and easier.
Yeah, 100%.
You were certainly wearing a lot of hats, bringing Water Party to the stage. It must have been quite difficult to sit back and just kind of observe the work from the playwright's perspective. Do you think that will change going forward?
That's such an interesting question. I definitely want to say yeah, but probably no. It is really hard. You're right. It's really hard. I come from sketch comedy.
Okay.
That's my background in Los Angeles, and filming. And so this was a big exercise in letting go of control, because once the lights are up and I've said my little introduction, that I can't yell cut. There's nothing in I can't fix anything in post. Like, it's a living, breathing. It's its own. I guess it's probably a bit like having kids, where like you do your best and then they're going to do what they're going to do. And I think that was a huge learning curve for me. And I hope that next time it's my piece, I can enjoy it a little bit more. I did get a lot out of seeing it. I had a few people come who I really admire, who gave me some really cool feedback and took time. And, you know, there's something about when someone is giving you feedback and they keep having ideas, and that makes you feel good, because you're like, oh, you're into it. You're not like, it sparked something in you. That's cool.
Yeah.
And so I actually did get a lot of really cool feedback, and I'm now working on rewriting it with the hopes of, putting it up a bit more fully fleshed out for maybe like 3 nights at the end of the year, to be able to invite the National and like Don Mar and Park Theatre and stuff, and see if anyone wants to take it on. But with Bespoke, that is generally up to the writer. I wouldn't do that necessarily for a different writer's work unless they spearhead that.
Yeah, and I imagine finance it as well.
yeah, figure out where that's going to come from. And also not all of the writers, not every writer that we put up's goal is to go to the West End. Some of them just want to tell a cool story and see it realized. And that's also really beautiful. One of the core principles of Bespoke is art for art's sake.
I think that's a really important thing to remember, actually. Not the end goal for every project is not the same.
100%.
Some things only need to be realized as a taped monologue on YouTube, or a reading in front of an invited small audience, or a fully staged reading, or, you know, a recorded as a podcast drama, or whatever that might be for that piece, and realizing work in different ways. You know, we can't measure success the same for every project.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think that's really important to remember, just as artists, like what we're doing. It's so hard in a world where you have to pay your rent and eat to separate, though, the commerce aspect from the art.
Yeah.
And I think it's something that's worth actively doing on a pretty consistent basis if you want to stay in love with what you're doing.
Definitely.
Because I always think I can really tell when I see a piece that was obviously created with a lot of love. That's so much more important to me than, like, is the story clever or is there a star in it? I think that people forget how impactful that is, and also that you can't fake it.
Yeah.
And that people, whether or not they are aware that that's what they're experiencing, it will be more impactful if it was made with love. 100%. It'll stick with people. And I think we've got to, it's really hard because the society does not help. Like, society is not on side of creating art for art's sake, but that's what we as creatives have to keep in focus and demand.
Back yourself. You have to back yourself. It feels like very often there is very little funding and even less support sometimes, that we have to champion each other and back ourselves.
And that, what you say, we have to champion each other as well. We have to back ourselves. We also have to back our peers and our loved ones in this journey.
So in terms of the future for Bespoke Plays, you have these two contingents now on both sides of the pond.
Yeah.
You're based in London. The other guys are in LA. Are there plans to work together? How do you see that working? What's coming up? What's next?
We're getting ready to do the next one for Bespoke. It's 7 people again. I don't know why I keep doing this to myself, but that's a lot of people to schedule. So I have not been able to find a time that's as early as I want for all 7 people to do our first read through, which we'll do over Zoom. So I'm going to do 2. A group of them will be at one, a group of them will be at the other. Obviously, I need people to read those parts. So I went to Bespoke LA, our actors there, and I said, hey, is anyone free? Can you come and pinch hit at this reading?
Well, that's the great thing, isn't it, about Zoom? That's how you can kind of really tie and kind of leverage both sides of the pond there with what you're doing.
Yeah, 100%. And they all, because they are the Bespoke crew, which I do think they are a special, like, different kind of people. They're all like, yeah, of course, I've got a couple hours. Let's play. Yeah. They just want to play.
Yeah.
And I think that's also what Bespoke tries to keep at the core, is the play and not everything has to be ready to go to the West End or Broadway, or it's about the process and the journey.
What would you say to anybody considering self-funding a reading of their work?
I would say, if you're in the UK, there are theatres who will let you pay at the end. That was huge for us for the first one. I would say do it. And I would say you've got to believe in yourself. Just like the story you told about making the thing because you thought you could, and why not?
Yeah.
And maybe if it had been 10 years later, you would have gone, well, I can't do that.
Yeah.
No one can just do that. And then you wouldn't have made it.
Right.
And so do it. The worst thing that will happen is you'll fall on your face, and literally everyone's fallen on their face, and you'll learn. The worst thing that'll happen is you'll only learn. And what else is there? So do it.
Brilliant. Brilliant. I'll add links to all your stuff so everyone can find you in the show notes. And Mimi, thank you so much for your time. It's been such a pleasure to chat to you. You've been so generous with all your insights and tips, and I can't wait to share this. So thank you.
Oh, thank you, Paul. I hope I didn't ramble too much.
Not at all. Not at all.
And I hope I get to see you when you come to London.
Yeah, that would be lovely. I'd love that. We'll definitely have coffee. Coffee and cakes on me. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. Bye.
The conversation continues after these messages. The Writer's Toolkit is published by Nick Hearn Books. Order direct from the publisher and get 20% off this and other great titles. Visit nickhearnbooks.co.uk. This podcast is fueled by coffee. If you'd like to support the show, you'll find the Buy Me a Coffee link in the show notes. Welcome back to the Writer's Toolkit podcast.
My next guest is Rachel Lynette, a queer Afro-Latinx playwright, producer, and teaching artist.
Rachel's plays have been staged at prestigious venues including the San Diego Rep, Magic Theatre, Barrington Stage Company, and the Kennedy Center Page to Stage Festival. They are the 2021 recipient of the Yale Drama Prize for their play Apologies to Lorraine Hansberry, You Too, August Wilson, and also won the 2021 National Latinx Playwriting Award. Other accolades include being a Blue Ink Award finalist in both 2022 and 2023. Rachel also served as a staff writer for the CW dark fantasy drama The Winchesters. And just to say, this is only part of my conversation with Rachel. There'll be much more later in the series when we chat about Rachel's experience starting a playwriting collective in Arkansas, plus founding a theatre company in their own name on their own terms. Part of the offering of which included a series of Zoom readings. And it's that part of the conversation that I'm bringing to you in this episode.
Hi.
Hey, Rachel. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So this is kind of in reverse order for the listeners, because later in the series, we'll talk about your interest in playwriting collectives.
Yeah.
And what you were trying to get off the ground in Arkansas.
Yeah, totally.
But out of that was born the Rachel Lynette Theatre Company, which was a wholly online proposition from the off.
Yeah.
So what's the origin story there?
Up until 2021, I've always wanted to start a theater company of my own. And I feel like I keep trying and failing, and I kept trying and failing. And so with Rachel at Theater Company, the things that made it really different for me that wasn't true for Arkansas Theater Collective is everyone was virtual from jump. We were like, this is going to be a digital thing. And so the need for space wasn't as important anymore. And space, paying to rent spaces, was a big part of our expenses. And so that was the first one, not needing a space. And two, having a much wider audience, because I knew I could attract a wider audience if I wasn't stuck to the who was 50 miles, right?
Yeah.
And I had a bigger name at that time. So like me versus like what, 2015, where I'm like fresh out of grad school versus like fresh, like 2020 Rachel, who had all these awards. I'd been a finalist for the O'Neill. Like I'd been produced a couple, like way more name, not a lot, but more name recognition. Yeah. So I thought that I would be more successful. But again, the biggest thing was we were always going to be virtual. Well, at least for the first 2 years. There was talk of by the third year we'd move, but we were in three different states, so we couldn't figure out where.
So what was your mission statement at the beginning? What was driving the ambitions of the company?
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to pause for this because I actually really love our mission statement and I want to go find it. Okay. So let's see. The mission statement for Rachel Lynette Theatre Company was... Our mission is to radically work against the ways in which the institution of theater has prioritized and centered cisnormative whiteness by producing plays that center queerness and characters of color, creating more opportunities on stage and off for communities marginalized by traditional structures. We'll do this by producing the plays of Rachel Lynette and plays by queer and or women of color playwrights that are in conversation with Rachel Lynette's work, in line with our mission to decolonize American theater.
Wow.
That was the mission.
Wow. It's wonderful.
It was big.
Yeah, for sure. But I love the idea of producing work that's in conversation with your work. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm interested to hear whose work your work is in conversation with or inspired by as it filters down.
Yeah, my work's always been inspired by Susan Laurie Parks, Carol Churchill, Jose Rivera. Those are the big names for me.
Yeah.
Also Griselda Gambaro, who's an Argentine playwright. So for me, that's, I think, I hope my work is in conversation with.
Mm.
And when I was looking for other people, like who else is writing about queer people of color? Who else is writing about the diaspora in the same way? Who else is writing about transness and gender identity in the same way? And so originally the plan was going to be three plays by me. And then the fourth play was going to be a play in conversation with my work from that season.
Yeah.
But again, specifically looking for a queer playwright or a woman of color. That was the plan.
Yeah. So in a sense that you were building these kind of seasons each year, mm-hmm. was there a central kind of, you know, like a thematic starting point for each season, or how did you kind of curate the work around that?
So the first season's theme, I would say, was probably like plays that decolonize American theater. So like the first play we led with to kind of do the decolonizing theater is a play of mine called I'm Fucking Tired of Writing Plays About This.
Mm.
So it just gets straight into it. Like, I want to talk about the complexity of race. I want to talk about violence against queer people, but I don't want it to only be that conversation anymore. I don't want the only plays by Latinx playwrights to be about immigration. Not saying that they're important, but there are such other plays I want to talk about. And so that was the season's theme of the first season, the 2020 to 2021 season. We did like three plays of mine. We fully did four. We did all four. It had to be me. The reason why it had to be me really quickly is because we also, part of our mission was we pay everybody the same. So to me, a really big part of decolonizing theater is also decolonizing the pay structures. Like, I've worked at too many theater companies where, as the company manager, I was paid $20K and the artistic director was making $150K, you know? So we made it where everyone gets paid the same. And because everyone got paid the same, we don't have to pay royalties on my place. So to make sure we could equally pay the actors what all of us are making by the hour, we just did my place because we didn't pay me any royalties.
Okay.
So that was the first season, four plays of mine. We did it. Woo, we did it. Ran out of money. And so the second season, we did things like playwright slams, where I invited literary managers I knew, and I invited playwrights to read from their work, and then ask literary managers, like, whose email address can I pass you? Like, who can I pass you on to? And we did like two of those. It was really cool. I'd love to do it again. I've been thinking about doing it again, but like, I was like, I know a bunch of literary managers and I know a bunch of playwrights and they need to meet.
So Zoom is really interesting in terms of digital theater, creating content on Zoom as a starting point versus filmed stage productions. Were you rehearsing your plays on Zoom ahead of these public performances? And how did the two differ? What did a Zoom rehearsal look like versus a Zoom production?
So we never did the fully. So I did do a play with a different theater company where they had like a digital background.
Okay.
And it really did. And the actors were all off book. And I say this as respectfully as I can, because I'm really thankful that that company, the work that the director put into that, and you have a TV background, and I've worked in TV. It feels like bad TV shows when we do that. Like, it doesn't feel like theater to me anymore. It feels like something on Tubi, which is not to talk bad about. That's a fantastic source. I think people should be using it. Yeah. So what we decided to do, because that's kind of how we felt about it, is we basically did, like, so it's preaching to the choir, because everybody knows about this, but like back in like the 70s, right? 1970s American theater, where people were, they're all black, and they wore their, they had the scripts in their hand, and it was all minimalist theater.
Yep.
That's kind of the vibe we were going for, just virtually.
Okay.
So we did have rehearsals. It wasn't in a cold reading, which we did do one of. We did do a cold reading just to see how people would respond to it. But if they were rehearsed, we would like talk over like, hey, can you try this? We had costumes, but we made it very clear that people were reading it and it was still a production. And like, it was a conversation that we had to have. And I was thankful to have of like, this is what theater kind of used to do. Like, theater companies used to go on bars and they would wear their cute little hats and they would switch hats when they were switching characters. Like, and that's my favorite kind of theater. And Zoom makes it really easy to do that. So that, for us, the difference was it was rehearsed. To answer your question, the difference between the reading versus the production.
Yeah.
It was fully rehearsed. The actors were semi off book, but they didn't have to be fully off book. And there was costumes and like some medium sound effects because Zoom sound wasn't great in the beginning.
Yeah.
Learning how to do live theater over Zoom, I think for everybody, was a challenge. Because it was like people telling people to mute and like, do you do it in a webinar? Do you not do it in a webinar? How do you see chats if it's a webinar? Like, you want people to raise their hand in the middle of your production. So I will say it was trial and error for us, like it was for everybody. What we ended up doing was we did do just a normal Zoom room and we had like the stage manager muting and turning people's cameras off.
Okay.
But I kind of liked that more because it felt like sometimes people get up and walk across the stage.
Right,
you just got to
react
to it.
Yeah.
You know?
There's that lady with the toffees. There's that guy going to the bathroom for the seventh time.
Right. It's like, there you go. And it's always during a very touching moment. Like, that's part of what we love about it. I did see a really cool, there was a theater company I worked with. We didn't do this, but just to say it, they did a recording where they shared their screen, but like the audience was live. And so they could comment, but the performance was recorded. Okay. And I actually did kind of like that.
Okay.
But we didn't do that. We did it fully live with a very stressed out stage manager muting and turning cameras off every second. Yeah.
That's great. And a really natural way to continue the conversation, right? To have a talk back afterwards. You know, you've already got the audience there. You've got you can just jump in as a facilitator and lead that conversation. Did you do that? Mm-hmm. Were you doing talkbacks directly off the back?
I love talkbacks. Yeah. We did a talkback after every show. I know people hate them. I love the reasons that people hate them is actually why I love them. But, you know, we did a talkback after every single show. So.
So how are you finding your audience then for these live streams?
Well, Facebook.
Okay.
Honestly, like what we did was, so Facebook, I would just post and be like, hey, like, please come buy. We sold tickets. We did sell tickets. It was pay what you can. We had a base fee, but we didn't want anyone to not be able to do it. We also like Broadway World lets you put ads up. So we did that. And just word of mouth and using our different networks. And like I said, like so many of my networks have been in places I haven't lived. And so being able to be all online was very easy to be like, hey, I know you're in Florida and you're in a different time zone, but come to this, like, if you're free.
Well, that's got to be the beauty of doing it online, right? That you can reach not just your cast and your company, but your audience can be anywhere.
Right. Yeah. It was really cool. So yeah, that's basically how we did it. It was all online marketing. Okay.
That's great.
We sold tickets online. They were pay what you can, sort of. So there was a minimum. And then it was like, if you can pay more, please pay more. This is how we pay the actors. And then if anyone ever couldn't afford it, we told them just to email me and I gave them a free ticket.
I just think I love the idea that what Zoom has provided is something super accessible, no barriers to entry, mm-hmm. no gatekeepers in terms of playwrights being able to share their work, you know, very quickly, be able to fail, you know, without the cost, and to be able to play, experiment, you know, throw sand outside the sandbox, color outside the lines. It's a great way to be able to do that very quickly, right? Mm-hmm. That's exciting.
Yeah, no, that's what I loved about it. I really wish we didn't use Zoom for work because I think people would have been so much more willing to be on Zoom. I totally get how people got Zoomed out, but I feel like if we didn't use it for work, it would have lasted a lot longer.
Yeah.
Because you're right, the accessibility is unmatched.
Yeah.
You know?
Do you have any advice for playwrights considering getting their work off the ground with a Zoom reading?
Be honest about where you're at. An audience will appreciate that. I know someone who did a Zoom reading, who really wanted people there because she really wanted feedback, but she didn't tell people it was a draft or that it wasn't rehearsed. And so we went there and then like people were like, what page am I on? And you get frustrated because that's not what you thought you were coming for. Whereas if you just say like, hey, this is a cold reading, or hey, this is a rehearsed reading, and let people know that before they commit to it,
right,
is just be very upfront about what you want to get from it is my biggest advice for a Zoom reading for playwrights that want to test drive their work that way. My next advice is, and I'm sorry because I write short plays. This was really biased, but if your play is longer than 2 hours, don't you dare. Don't you dare. Like, no, thank you. No, we're not. No, absolutely not. If you don't do a 4-hour play on a Zoom reading, please don't do that to us. Split it up or like have a very sexy intermission and trust that people will come back. Yeah. And some people won't. And that's okay. But also like no, 90 minutes after 90 minutes, especially on Zoom, people are like, I can't do this anymore. So yeah, I recently sat through a 4-hour play and I wanted to die. So
at least in a Zoom reading, you can leave, you know, in the theater, sometimes sitting through a 4-hour play is the worst.
You're just stuck there. It's like, oh no, August Osage was not written for Zoom. You know, like there's levels here. So
respect your audience.
Yes. Respect your audience. And also, I guess like really quickly too, like, don't be afraid to show pieces of things. I think Zoom is actually really great. Even if you have, let's say you have an 80 minute and you're like, I only have these 20 pages locked down solid. I think Zoom actually works a lot better for that than it does in person, because no one's pissed that they drove 30 minutes for 20 minutes because they didn't drive anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. So. And maybe there's something in recording the piece and saying to the audience, hey, anybody who can't stay, you'll receive a link to watch the second half at your leisure.
Definitely. Yeah. We recorded all of ours so we could send it to people.
So the Rachel Lynette Theatre Company, is that on pause right now?
Yeah. We did a temporary pause in 2022.
Okay.
I really loved being in control of my work and like having these the same conversations, but feeling, like you said, like having power, like feeling like I can go no. And I didn't think it was going to cancel my production because I was producing it, you know?
Yeah.
So I would get notes on the plays because I would still get notes because I think that we should be collaborative. But I felt okay. I felt a lot more comfortable going, no, I don't agree with that. And the risk of it not being produced was really freeing. Rachel Lynette Theatre Company gave me a chance to be both admin and playwright in a way that was really beautiful that I miss. Mm. And I feel like I've lost some of the power that I had, because before it was like a theatre company. I've got a play right now that I'm like, I just know that the second I produce this play myself, it's going to be everywhere, but I don't have the time and I don't have the energy and I don't have the money. So that I miss. And then also like I had to get a day job again. And then right after that I got staffed for TV. So it's like other things that have gotten in the way of playwriting. But the theater company, blessedly, was never, ever an obstacle, which I really love and miss, actually.
That's wonderful. It's really great to hear that it was such an enriching and inspiring and affirming experience for you.
Yes.
Thanks for sharing your experience, Rachel. So many great tips and wonderful insight there.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This has been really fun.
A massive thank you to both Mimi and Rachel for joining the conversation. I'll leave their links in the show notes if you'd like to connect and find out more about their work. And of course, I'll bring you the rest of my chat with Rachel later in the series.
Next time
I'll be joined by writer and performer Jonathan Blakely and Heather Jeffrey, the editor of London Pub Theatres magazine, talking all about the magic of London Pub Theatres as a vital platform for new writing.
There is something very, very special about those spaces.
I think they're just places of just pure bravery, and they're really open to people being experimental there because they want to draw exciting new creatives in.
White Bear, for example, they find that people come and try out their shows at White Bear Theatre, and then they go on to do a number one tour, or they take it to the West End.
I think one of the really famous success stories of pub theatres, you have to look at Mischief is the name of the group to do the Play That Goes Wrong series. They started, I think, at the Old Red Lion.
They are great launching pads, but at the same time, they're also great places for people to just find work there. And some people actually just keep within the pub theatre circuit.
Well, I hope this episode has provided some ideas and inspiration for the development journey of your writing. Don't forget to subscribe so you hear when the next episode is published. I'd love it if you could leave some stars wherever you're listening to this. That would be wonderful and help other writers find the podcast too. Until next time, stay inspired.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Writers Toolkit podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd love for you to leave a review and share the link with your friends. This podcast is fueled by Ko-fi. If you'd like to support the show, you'll find the Buy Me a Ko-fi link in the show notes.